It's a great pleasure to have with me for this conversation Christian Billinger, investor at Billinger Verwaltning, a family-held investment company with no external capital. The simplicity of the setup, as well as permanent and patient capital, provides Christian with a proper environment to pursue his strategy of identifying long-term compounders. I would just draw your attention that we have interviewed Christian in the past. That interview is available on the MY Global website, and Christian has also shared an article with the MY Global community on downside protection, which I also encourage you to read. This conversation, Christian, I'd love to focus on a topic that's timely but also timeless in a sense. It concerns the differences between investing through an open-end fund versus a closed-end investment company like the one you run, both in times of market volatility as well as more generally. So I'd like to turn it to you for your thoughts and remarks on this topic, and then we'll have a Q&A after that. So please go ahead.
Right, thank you very much for the introduction, John, and for doing the call. I hope you and anyone else listening is doing well. So I thought what could be interesting is to, you know, we often talk about idea generation, and I thought what could be interesting is to also look at the structure through which we implement those ideas. And in other words, to look at the sort of liability side as well as the asset side. And one of the reasons that I thought now's a good time to sort of revisit this theme is because looking back at 2008, 2009, you know, I still work for an institutional money manager at the time. So, you know, both long and long short money, but those were open end structures. And since 2015, I've been running money through a private vehicle, which is closed-end, as you mentioned. So I thought I could share a few experiences around what the differences are, really. And I guess it's important to emphasize, John, that I'm certainly not saying one is better than the other, but I think the structure you choose to operate through needs to be consistent with the philosophy and the process. There's really three sort of broad areas or segments I wanted to cover, John. And the first one is around the structure, if you will, which includes the legal and operational aspects of, you know, closed end as I run today compared to open end, and how they might sort of impact your ability to take advantage, if anything, of a downturn like the one we're currently experiencing. So I guess the most important thing to me is this idea of permanent capital. And I guess in a very basic sense, what I mean by that is the fact that there aren't any cash flows, you know, certainly going out, probably not going in either, to be perfectly honest, with the setup we have. And, you know, there's a spectrum here all the way from funds that offer daily liquidity to, at the other end, more of what I do now, a sort of private closed-end structure where you don't have any external capital and you don't have any leverage. And in between those two, there's a number of sort of variations. You know, they could be investment trusts. They could be funds, but with some sort of restrictions or lockups, or say, you know, monthly dealing, for instance. So, you know, I don't think it's a black or white. There's a spectrum here. And I also think it's important to consider that, in my view at least, no capital is truly permanent, in the sense that, you know, we often look at this from the right-hand side of the balance sheet, and we say, if you're equity financed, or if you run a Berkshire kind of structure where you have an insurance operation with float, then you have permanent capital. I actually think we also need to look at the asset side in addition to the liability side. So, you know, for instance, if you're operating an insurance business, you know, in the unlikely event that you either have a runoff of the insurance float or you make losses on your underwriting for a sustained period of time, then effectively your capital isn't permanent. What you thought was permanent capital turns out not to be permanent. And I think it's similar with, you know, if you run a fund or an investment company, if you make bad investments, or if your investments are so unsuccessful that they go to zero, then it turns out the capital wasn't permanent. And, you know, I know it's a very extreme case, but I think it's worth mentioning, you know, even if you'd financed a position in Lehman Brothers or Enron or any other, you know, pick an example, even if you'd financed those with equity, you know, that's not really permanent capital. So I think you need to look at the quality of the asset base as well. So that's the first point. And, you know, effectively, all we're trying to do, John, is to sort of extend the time frame until we hit what some would call the absorbing barrier. You know, if you do this for long enough over sort of if you look at a sort of multi-generational kind of setting, sooner or later you'll run into trouble. And I guess all we're trying to do is make sure that we give ourselves as much runway as possible before we get to that point. I also think it's worth mentioning that this idea of path dependence is much more relevant for an open-end structure. So, you know, if you set up a fund, say you'd set up a fund on the 1st of January this year, I think the drawdowns most funds have experienced since then might have meant that they were unable to actually carry on business. Whereas if you run a private closed-end structure, you know, you once again, you're sort of buying yourself time. So whether you sort of lose 50% and make 100, or whether you you know, make 100 and lose 50, makes less difference than if you're running an open-end structure. So another aspect of this legal operational side of things, John, is in the setup that I operate now, I have much more flexibility in managing the balance sheet. So whether it's holding 5 or 10 or 20% cash, or whether it's employing leverage, I have a lot of freedom, you know, partly because it's an unregulated entity, because there are no outside investors in it. But also because a lot of funds have a mandate that tells them, and especially tells their investors, that we will, you know, we will be no more than 5 or 10% cash. And usually, you know, there are some differences here if you look at the hedge fund world or investment trust world. But if we sort of stick to traditional mutual funds, there's very little room to maneuver in terms of the balance sheet. I think, and on the point of leverage, I think it's important to also consider leverage at the owner level. So, you know, I'll take a recent example that was in the FT over the weekend, which is SoftBank. And in addition to the leverage you have at the company level, there's now, and you know, we don't know yet how this will sort of work out, but there's also the issue now of leverage at the owner level. So, you know, if you have a sort of large shareholder that has used their shareholding as collateral for loans unrelated to the business as well, then you might have an issue that might impact the business. And I guess famously, you look at Buffett, and I don't think, you know, everyone's very comfortable that there would never be that issue at Berkshire. So I think that's often overlooked, but I think it's an important consideration. So I'll just mention a few more differences in terms of legal and operational differences here. So, you know, running a closed-end structure, the cost base, or the certainly the fixed cost base, I think can be a lot lower than if you run a open-end kind of structure with outside investors. You know, usually you need analyst resources, you need compliance, you need marketing, you need all sorts of headcount. And it's much easier in a way to shrink, you know, if you need to, you know, if you need to because your assets have been shrinking, you know, as a lot of people will have experienced in the last few weeks. I think in a closed-end structure, especially if it's a private, unregulated operation, you can take out a lot of cost. And so you're, once again, you're sort of buying yourself time. So that minimum scale to operate, I think, is much smaller for a private structure. The ability to be more concentrated is, I think, generally speaking, once again, there's exception to this. You know, there's mechanism you can use, lockups and what have you. But generally speaking, you can be more concentrated and less liquid in a private closed-end structure. You know, I'll just mention one example in the UK, which was all over the news last year, which is Woodford Investment Management, which I think had the issue of this mismatch between the liquidity on the, you know, for investors and the liquidity of the assets they were invested in. And so that needs to be managed very carefully. I think there are ways around that. If you look at investors who have a very long, successful track record, for instance, that's one way of actually giving yourself that room to maneuver. So, you know, if you look at two very popular UK names, Nick Train at Linsell Train and Terry Smith at Fundsmith, they have a following that enables them to sort of ride out the ups and the downs to some extent. Ultimately, you know, that used to be the case for Neil Woodford, and it is no longer. So there's a limit to that, but I'd say that that can sort of give you some cushion. But obviously, that's very hard unless you have a very long and successful track record. And then finally, on the sort of structural side of things, I think the incentives and the alignment differ. Now, you could argue that in a lot of funds, the PM will typically be invested and significantly invested. So they'll put a large portion of their liquid net worth into the fund. But they're still generating fees on their AUM, etc. So I think for various reasons, it's a much more direct alignment if you have a private structure where, you know, which is owned by the people who run it. And basically, the incentive comes from ownership of the equity in the business. So those are some of the sort of differences in terms of the structure, and they obviously have implications for the way you can manage the portfolio. So I wanted to get on to the second topic, John, of how this sort of impacts the process. And I guess the most important thing there is the way it extends your time horizon if you operate the closed-end kind of format, because you don't have any cash flows, because you're focused on the equity value instead of looking at what's my annual bonus going to be, etc. You can take a much longer view, which is helpful, especially in times like these. I think there's less emphasis in a closed-end structure. You know, if I look at what I do now compared to just over 10 years ago, I place a lot less emphasis, and I think this is true generally, on prediction. You know, I'm not trying to figure out where the market's going in the next sort of week or month, or have we reached a bottom, or what sort of triggers are there. I sat down and I thought about the last 10 years or 10 plus years. If you look at the financial, you know, what's happened since then, you've had the financial crisis, 08, 09. You've had various sort of iterations of the euro crisis. You've had Brexit. You've had Trump in the White House. You've had, you know, currently coronavirus. And all these events, I guess, I don't think anyone could honestly say that they would have sort of predicted any one of them, and let alone sort of most of them. And I think even if you had, I mean, it would have been very difficult to figure out what the implications were for markets. And I think for that reason, what I do is I look much more at the fundamentals of the businesses and the quality of those businesses, and ultimately their ability to survive, as opposed to the near-term share price action. Currently, for instance, if I feel I can buy these great businesses at a fair or better price, then I'm happy to do so, and I'm not going to worry too much about have we reached a bottom. I listened to your very interesting conversation with Howard Marks, where I think he talked about this concept of, if assets look like decent value, then we'll be buying some, and we're not trying to figure out where the bottom is. And I think, unless you have a sort of brand name, you're relying on, or I'm relying on this, on the fact that the capital, my capital is very sort of sticky, at least, if not permanent. So a few more differences in terms of the process. In this closed-end environment, I feel there's much less pressure to act or seem to be acting. So if you're running a fund with outside investors, even if you think there's nothing to do, your investors probably feel you should be doing something. And it's very hard from a marketing point of view not to be doing anything. And it's much easier if it's private money to be saying there's nothing to, it's the old saying of if there's nothing to do, do nothing. And you can actually live by that. There's less pressure to look smart. And I guess this comes back to the idea of reversion. You're not trying to be smart. You're just trying not to do anything obviously stupid. But it's much easier to implement that idea in a private environment. It's very hard to go to your investors, outside investors, in an open end or more of a commercial setup and say, what we've done. So Q1 this year, for instance, we've done is we've tried not to be obviously stupid. It's not a good sort of line of communication from a marketing point of view. And then finally, in the terms of the process, you allocate your time very differently, I find. So I spend a lot more time in this downturn reading, whether it's annual reports or quarterly statements or books or, manual of ideas, all sorts of sources. So more time on reading and thinking and less time on market watching. Although I have to say that I spend much more time market watching now than I would normally. And I think it's important to still remember that, Charlie Munger often refers to this idea that when the opportunities arise, you need to act aggressively. And so, we are keeping a very close eye on the market, and especially individual names, either current holdings where we might want to buy more, or companies we like, and that there's this great sort of entry opportunity has opened up. So I think the ability and the willingness to act aggressively is still important. And for instance, I have invested a significant portion of my cash holdings in February and March, but that's been based on the fundamentals of the businesses. So all of this together, I think, John, means that in my view, volatility becomes much more of your friend in a private sort of environment. When I say private, I mean a closed end kind of structure. And then I guess the last topic I wanted to touch on is, we can call it behavioral. It's really this idea of life expectancy as an investor, or runway. And, this refers both to the financial and emotional dimensions of running money. I think it involves anything from stress levels you know, the stress of having outside investors and in a sort of drawdown, to, you know, whether you have the financial sort of robustness to endure for long periods of time. I just thought I'd mention a few examples, and I'm absolutely certain every, you know, all your members are very familiar with these. And I should say there, these are not people who sort of ended up not running money anymore. In fact, they're the most successful people you could ever imagine in the money management business. But they have moved from an open-end structure to more of a closed-end structure. I guess, the most famously, Buffett and the Buffett partnerships in the late 60s. And, you know, when he told investors that he was returning their money because he felt the markets didn't offer the risk reward or the opportunities that they had done, I do get a sense that that he did not want to put other people's money at risk. I mean, he obviously, you know, put that money into Berkshire, and the rest is history. But the structure as such, the partnership structure with external money, for most of us, if we're looking to run one sort of structure for a very long period of time, I think there are challenges there. Munger Wheeler, early 70s, is another example where I think Charlie Munger has said on a number of occasions that he just felt that the stress of running other people's money, especially in a big drawdown, was just too much. And he was quite, I think he said himself that he was quite happy, well, presumably not happy, he was willing to endure losing his own money, sort of mark to market at least. He was not prepared to do that with other people's money. I'm sure they would have felt the same way in the late 90s when they saw what was happening to sort of technology stocks in the US. But with the structure they had in place at that point, you can just ride out the ups and the downs. I'll give you two slightly more recent examples. I mean, Peter Lynch, when he retired from Magellan in 1990, he referred to, and you could sort of debate whether that was the actual reason or not, but he certainly always referred to the fact that the sort of physical and emotional stress of running a large fund. Now, he had a very high touch kind of approach, a lot of names in the portfolio. He'd been running the fund for 13 years and, he wanted to do something else. But and the last example is Stan Druckenmiller. When he closed Duquesne Capital in 2010 to outside investors and then converted that whole thing into a family office. And, he also said that coming out of the financial crisis, the markets were just draining him physically and emotionally, and he didn't want to do it anymore. So, once again, as I said, all of these examples are people who then continued investing, either in the case of Buffett and Munger through Berkshire, or, you look at Druckenmiller and he's running Duquesne Family Office. I think my point is just that if the structure as such may be more durable if it doesn't involve significant amounts of outside money with all the emotional sort of pressures that entails. I think just two final points, John. I think also what it does is it enables you to lower your expectations, which sounds, maybe odd, but I think for instance, you can be much more prudent in risk taking. If you look at Peter Lynch, between 77 and 90, when he ran Magellan, he compounded at just over 29%, I think, after fees. But let's say for simplicity, at 30%, and I think Druckenmiller had similar numbers over a long period of time, these were very high touch, high intensity strategies. So these guys did 30% for extended periods of time. So for Peter Lynch, it took 13 years for doing 30x. If you look at Buffett's 20% over long periods of time, I mean, these are sort of simplified examples, but it would take you about, instead of 13 years, it would take you 18 and a half years to do 30x. If you look at, I think what most people would say is a more realistic assumption for market returns, who knows, but you know, it's anybody's guess. But if we look at 10%, and I think often people who are sort of long-term investors in equities, developed world equities at least, would say, I think I can maybe do 8 to 12%, say over a long period of time. Then over 36 years, which admittedly is a long time, but over 36 years, you would get to the same endpoint that, you know, Lynch got to in 13 years, or, you know, Buffett got to in, say, 18 and a half years. You know, I know that's not true for the entire period of Berkshire, but these are just examples to make that point, that you can lower your expectations and you can say, do you know what, if I can do 10%, that'll do very nicely. Obviously, you know, if you end up doing better than that, great, but at least you're not having to go far out on the risk scale to chase returns, and you can just increase your focus on compounding over long periods of time. Final point, I think it just enables you to enjoy the process much more. You can say to yourself, there's no hurry. I enjoy what I'm doing. You know, if I can do 8 or 10 or 12%, or, you know, pick a number, over very long periods of time. And remember, I think, you know, this sort of structure actually gives you better life expectancy as an investor. If I can generate those sort of returns over a long period of time, you know, I'll do very well, and I'll enjoy it in the meantime. Those were my remarks, John. I hope that gives you some sense of how, you know, I feel that this private environment is different from the public one. And I think I can't say that it's better for everyone, but I certainly think that, you know, if you have a mindset and a process and a philosophy that is very long term and bottom up and all the rest of it, then I think it's something to consider, or at least look at the sort of benefits of running that kind of structure. The issue is obviously that it's a bit of a slow grind. You're not going to generate fees unless you're running an investment trust, say, as an external manager. You're not going to generate fees on other people's money. So, you know, building up your own capital will take longer. But you know, if you enjoy doing it, then, you know, what's the hurry? So those were my remarks, John, and I'd be very interested in any thoughts or questions you might have.
Well, Christian, thank you so much. Very interesting perspective. You talk about life expectancy as an investor. I would argue that your life expectancy generally probably goes up as well.
I think you're right.
due to the lower stress involved. I'm wondering whether you could provide some perspective on kind of the timing, because I think many investors are thinking about doing something along the lines of what you have done.
Yeah.
But the initial stake is maybe not quite so large that one can live a you know, comfortable lifestyle if one were to just manage one's own money.
Yeah.
And B, the question is also, if, you know, unless you're starting with a really nice amount of capital, does that also then increase the pressure to perform if you need to grow it, as it were?
Yeah, it's a very good question, John. And, you know, when I sort of moved into this in 2015, I asked myself just those questions, because there's no doubt in the short to medium term, and possibly even in the very long sort of run, you know, I would have been financially better off working for a fund, you know, hopefully collecting a few sort of bonuses along the way. And so I think you're absolutely right. I think the first thing you need to ask yourself is that, am I willing to trade off some short to medium and possibly even long-term financial gain for other things, like the freedom to invest the way you want to, you know, hopefully over long periods of time, you will build up a meaningful sort of capital base. But I think it's, I almost think the best assumption is I'm not going to be financially as well off doing this as I would have been running a fund or working for a fund. Would I be willing to do it anyway? I think that's a good question. In this case, the capital really came out of a family business that had been involved in other activities, you know, industrial and commercial real estate. And I started putting money into listed equities for that business. I think there's, you know, it's once again, it's not a black or white. There's difference. It's a spectrum. So, you know, there are all sorts of options here. You know, there are investment trusts. I mean, in the UK, for instance, there's quite a few of these. In fairness, they require a certain scale. You know, they are listed vehicles with a meaningful number of investors, and you have some of the same issues you would in a fund. Obviously, that you know, you've even seen some sort of non-traditional players in that market, like Pershing Square, creating those sort of vehicles because I guess they want some of that permanence of capital. In Sweden, for instance, you have what we call investment bolag, which are publicly listed investment companies, but where you have a number of external investors. And that, you know, if you can pool capital together in that way, that means if you're running the whole thing, you can, you know, you can take a salary and you can sort of make it a viable business. But in fairness, yes, you still need a meaningful number of outside investors that are willing to put money into it. So I think if I would give any advice and try to sort of respond to your question, first of all, I think that's a sort of key point to consider. It's one question that anyone that is even thinking about this should ask themselves. And secondly, I think the timing, as you said, matters because, you know, I spent about 10 years working for other funds before I did this. And I think that's probably something I'd recommend. You know, the learning curve there is very steep. You get great exposure to, you know, corporate management teams, and, you know, you can actually learn while investing other people's money, and hopefully in that process build up some capital and that you can then use for setting up your own structure. I think it's much harder, you know, I don't think this is something you'd want to do straight out of, say, university, but I think, you know, depending on the trajectory you're on, 5 or 10 or 15 years down the road, I think it's certainly something to consider. But you might have to, you know, I think as Charlie Munger often says, you might have to just sort of lower your expectations, you know, lower your outgoings and sort of adjust your lifestyle, at least for a while. So there's lots of benefits, but I think in summary, you're not going to get to those benefits unless you're willing to sort of give up on something, at least short to medium term. Does that sort of make sense?
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you. Christian, talking a little bit about the crisis triggered by COVID-19, you alluded to being more active than usually because volatility does create interesting opportunities. Could you talk a little bit more about your process and how you decide how much cash to hold and also whether to reposition or rebalance the portfolio, you know, maybe away from some companies you feel are no longer as high quality or have as promising a future as some others that are on your watch list and that have now come into a very attractive range?
Absolutely. Yes. So I guess, first of all, I should say that the reason I found myself with, you know, a bit of cash to invest is because we had a sort of corporate event last year that meant I ended up with cash sitting on the balance sheet. So normally my ambition is to be relatively fully invested. You know, my sort of logic is, first of all, I'm looking for great businesses. I expect those to become more valuable over time. And secondly, I can't do market timing. So my conclusion from based on those two sort of points is that I should be more or less fully invested over time. So it's that's important to mention, because this is a bit of a one-off in a way. I'm sure cash levels will vary a little bit. You know, you collect dividends, and if you find it difficult to identify things that look attractive, then I'll hold on to that cash. And if I find a lot, which I have done recently, that looks attractive, I'll spend some of that cash. So, but these will be relatively small movements in my case. I think most of what I've spent money on have been existing holdings. And that's partly because, you know, I'm trying to run a relatively concentrated portfolio, which is, you know, coming back to some of the benefits, in my view, of running a closed-end structure is you can have as many or as few names in there as you like. I typically have about 20 holdings. And so I've been, and these are businesses I love, and I think they're very high quality and they have great sort of durability. So they're exactly the sort of businesses I want to own over the long term. And for that reason, most of the money I've spent on, you know, existing holdings. And I think the other aspect there, John, is that they tend to be companies you've looked at over a number of years. And so you tend to know them much better than if you're looking for new ideas. And that means, I find, that gives you a lot of comfort in times like these. So you have a better sense of how they'll behave operationally, and, you know, you have a better sense of valuations, you know, where you should be buying them, etc. I've added a couple of new holdings, but they are businesses that I've looked at for a long period of time before buying into them. So I, you know, in this sort of environment, I wouldn't find any entirely new ideas, because I think you need, you know, you ideally should have built up that understanding of the business for a long period of time. And I don't worry much about the portfolio level positioning, you know. So it's very much bottom up, but that means I find myself much more exposed to certain sectors. So unsurprisingly, you know, consumer staples and industrials would tend to be large overweights, if you will. But that just happens to be. So I think that's the way I've approached it. I've also added a few sort of holding type companies or investment trust companies where I like the managers and, you know, valuations look attractive. But I think the overall theme there, John, I guess, is in response to your question, is I've been adding more of what I already own. Because often, I think, as many noted investors say, often, you know, buying more of what you already own is the best investment. Did that cover all the points, John, that you mentioned?
Yeah, thank you. That's great. One little point on the trust structure you mentioned in the UK. So, in other words, a closed-end structure, but with outside investors.
Yeah,
I'm wondering. Whether you know to what extent the manager really does have permanent capital in that structure, because I recall in the US with closed-end funds, there was activism when those discounts got too large and there was pressure to open-end them. And that obviously, so you may have a closed-end structure, but if the discount to NAV, which you cannot control because it's a market discount, becomes large, all of a sudden you're dealing with pressures that you might have more in an open-end structure.
Absolutely. Great point, John. And it's one, I entirely agree with you. And so that's also why, you know, when I said there are sort of variations on these extremes of either, say, a daily dealing open-end structure or a private closed-end structure. I mean, the investment trusts typically end up somewhere in between. And I entirely agree with you. I think one of the issues is, you know, what maybe looks like permanent capital, as you said, if you, especially either in times of market stress or if you have sustained underperformance. And I think Pershing Square had, you know, Pershing Square Holdings had this issue. Obviously, they've had a big comeback. But what then tends to happen is a discount opens up and you're getting, you know, well, it's an issue if you're invested in, if as a manager, you're invested in the trust yourself. But it's also an issue in the sense that you refer to, that you may get pressure from outside investors. And if nothing else, I'm sure the emotional pressure is there, just like in an open-end structure. So I agree. I think, you know, they're a variation on this idea of permanent capital, but it's certainly not permanent in the sense that it doesn't give you the same room to maneuver, and it doesn't extend your time horizon as much as if it's, you know, purely private capital. And, you know, we've seen in this drawdown as well, and in fact I bought into one of these investment trusts in the UK, you know, who typically traded at, or certainly in the last few years traded at, sort of in line or even at premiums, or in some cases meaningful premiums to NAV. They've traded at discounts and sometimes meaningful discounts. And so I agree with you. I think you know, it's a popular idea because you can, if you're an external manager, or if you, you know, if you appoint an external manager, there's the opportunity, just like in a fund, to generate fees on other people's money. But, you know, there's no, I mean, I guess it's a tired expression, there's no free lunches. But I mean, effectively, I think it holds true here. You know, if you want the opportunity to generate those fees, you're going to have to live with the fact that you're somewhat dependent on what's on the market environment and on outside investors. So I agree with you. I think it's one, you know, variation. It may give you slightly a slightly more robust position than, say, daily dealing or weekly dealing, or but yeah, I mean, it's still, in my view, it's still a compromise depending on how you've structured it.
Christian, before we wrap it up, I'd love it if you could share any advice for someone who may want to start a closed-end structure, because I believe that the coronavirus crisis has laid bare the drawbacks of open-end structures, and I can imagine there are quite a few in the MOI community and elsewhere thinking about at least starting some sort of a closed-end structure. So any thoughts or advice you could share on getting that actually done would be helpful.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I guess the most helpful thing might just be to refer to my own experience, which is, I think it's a great idea. I've enjoyed it immensely. I'll be perfectly honest, when I started doing this in 2015, you know, I wasn't sure if I would, because it's, I think it takes a slightly different mindset. You know, you're not being sort of entertained by brokers in the same way, and by depending on the scale of the business, but by corporates, and, you know, you're probably, it's a slightly more sort of anonymous existence. But I think if you're, you know, if you love investing, in a long-term sort of fundamental way, I think I couldn't recommend it more. I think it's helpful to spend, you know, whether it's 5 or 10 or 15 years doing something else, getting some experience, you know, as the expression goes, being humbled by the markets. You know, I think it's helpful for me, for instance, having been through, you know, one or two of these downturns previously. So I think that's helpful. And that also enables you, as we mentioned, to build up a bit of capital. I think what I did when I started, so once you get to that, you know, say you have your 5 or 10 years, 15 years, you feel you've got a bit of experience and a bit of capital, and you've decided on the structure and what have you. What I did was to say, I want to take a very gradual approach. So I don't want to take on a lot of overheads. I'm not going to hire someone for the time being. You know, I'm not going to spend lots of money on an office or on, you know, on a Bloomberg terminal or any of that. And that comes back to the sort of fixed cost base. You know, if you can lower that break-even level, that is helpful. That sort of reduces your stress levels, and that I think increases your the likelihood that you'll be successful. And then gradually you can add these things. So, you know, I've started using, say, expert networks and sell side research to some extent, very, very sort of sparingly. But I think that gradual approach is very helpful. It takes a lot of stress off. I think in a broader sense, John, I think also you just need to ask yourself, does this suit me in terms of my temperament? You need to make sure your family is on board, you know, whether it's your partner or, you know, if you have children, and you need, all of this needs to sort of, that whole setup needs to work, because you may have a few years of not getting paid bonuses or sort of spending money you've saved. So I think ideally you should be pretty committed to the idea, because it takes a few years to sort of figure out whether it's working or not. And by that point, it may be difficult to go back to what you were doing. So those would probably be my key sort of main suggestions. But, you know, I couldn't enjoy it more. And I think to anyone that's even thinking about it, and certainly if anyone's interested in having a conversation about it, if it's helpful, I'd be very happy to share experiences with any of your members, John. So
wonderful. Well, truly appreciate that offer, Christian, and thank you so much for taking the time to have this conversation with me and share your perspective. I do think it's very valuable to our members.
No, thank you, John. I really enjoyed it, and thanks for some great questions. And thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, and all the best to you and your family in this turbulent period.
Likewise, John. Keep well, and speak to you soon.
Goodbye.
All the best. Bye.